Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute.
Today, my esteemed partner in crime, Mr. Bob Hoban, and I will be talking about the rise and fall of Delta 8 and what a rise and fall it was, Bob. We are seeing states ban this cannabinoid, which is very, very chemically close to Delta 9 THC, which of course is the prime suspect in the language of all of these farm bills and other federal language out there concerning the cannabis plant. So what are we to take of this wave of banning that we're seeing across multiple states now, kind of a domino effect almost, if you will, starting here in Colorado and now spreading out to Michigan and other places with the crackdown on Delta 8 THC?
Well, let's sort of talk about why Delta 8 THC is actually happening. First and foremost, you've had hundreds of thousands of acres of hemp biomass grown over the last several years, and it's gone nowhere. Or it's been extracted into a crude or some extract isolate, perhaps a CBD isolate, and it has nowhere to go. There's no regulated outlets to sell it that are viable and consistent. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, but I'm stressing viable and consistent there. So it's America. We were going to figure out how to use that stuff. So what are we doing with it now? We're creating it into turning it into Delta 8. And it really raises a couple of specific questions, and then we'll get to the ban. First and foremost, is Delta 8 THC a controlled substance? Well, it's not on the list of controlled substances. It's never been put on the list of controlled substances by Congress. It's never been formally put on the list of controlled substances by the DEA, even though the DEA does have that power administratively, particularly in an emergency scenario, if it believed there was an emergency scenario. So it's not a controlled substance. So then what is it? Well, that's another question. What is it? Is it a natural derivative of the plant? Or is it something that's synthetic or synthesized? This is the second issue. So is it a controlled substance? No. Is it synthetic or synthesized? That's really the question. And the law does not provide great guidance as to what it means by synthetic or synthesized. So there is Delta 8 THC in a hemp plant in its natural state, but in very small quantities. So what they're doing, and this was my point earlier, is they're taking the CBD isolate and or the biomass, and then ultimately converting it into Delta 8 THC. So it is a process. It's not just extracting it from a plant. You're taking another compound from the plant, and you're converting that compound based on a scientific and a chemical process into another compound that already does exist in the plant, but not in its natural state in these high quantities. So if it's synthetic or synthesized, is it legal? Well, that's really an FDA rule. If you're creating a new compound that doesn't exist in nature and it doesn't come directly from that source in nature in a direct pathway, is it regulated? So it's not so much is it legal, but is it regulated? Compound that further by the fact that it produces a pretty substantial intoxicating effect, psychoactive, psychotropic, however you want to describe it, to the point where I've been told when I was in Florida for spring break with my family, talking with a regular cannabis user who consumes cannabis every day and significant quantities of cannabis on the weekends, that person was literally on the floor, his words, not mine, in a ball hallucinating from 25 milligrams of Delta 8. And this is a bona fide regular THC user, to which I said, have you ever hallucinated or rolled up in a ball in any time ever from consuming cannabis, marijuana, THC? The answer was no, not even close. So there's something about this compound that we don't know what it is. So it's only natural to see the reflex position that we're kind of seeing come from these government agencies. Of course, the federal government moves slowly. It hasn't done anything. The DEA's position is that this is a controlled substance. And again, it's not. But is it legal because it's not regulated by the FDA? That's probably the best angle for the DEA. So there's this myriad of problems. Well, as the federal government sits back and posits, you know, it's this or it's that, and says, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, and rattles their saber, the states are left with a problem where there are people taking this and nobody really knows what it is. Yes, it's scientifically we know what it is. We don't know how it's produced in every case. There's no uniform process to make it. We don't know its long-term effects on the body if it's synthetic or synthesized. So the state governments who act the most swiftly are unfortunately left with stepping into the mix to prevent this thing from happening. And of all places, a place like Colorado. Although, let's examine that a little bit more deeply in just one second. But the point is, the states have to step in. The states are stepping in and saying that those types of products cannot and should not be sold in outlets, whether it's made from hemp and regulated by a Department of Health type agency. You're not allowed to do it. Whether it's in a marijuana, an additive into a quote unquote marijuana regulated business, not allowed to do that either because of the synthesized nature of it and the fact that it's not a direct compound. In fact, Colorado's gone as far to say is he can't take hemp extracts and put them into marijuana products right now. So there is a bunch of things happening, and it's going to happen. I read this morning, Michigan's lining up next. It's going to happen state after state after state, unless and until there's uniformity. Now, here's where the other pressure comes from. Not just politicians, not just law enforcement, not just, consumer groups that are concerned about what this stuff is and don't want kids and people just taking it because of the inconsistency about the actual product. The marijuana industry doesn't want people selling this stuff or using this stuff because it undercuts the marijuana industry. The marijuana industry's secret sauce is the ability to produce a product that, no bones about it, is intended to produce that intoxicating or psychoactive impact through high levels of THC or higher than in most products. If you're selling that over the counter in gas stations and otherwise, and you're competing with the marijuana industry, which has a lot of money and a lot to protect, you're going to be met with the kind of resistance that we're seeing right now. So there are strategies to sell it. There are arguments that it's legal, but that will not insulate you if DEA or the law enforcement agency in state X goes out, seizes it, and initiates a criminal proceeding. You're going to have to defend yourself, and you're going to have these arguments. And criminal defense attorneys will do a good job, but they need to be supplemented with people that understand these issues on a really nuanced and esoteric level. So that's what's happening, and it's not at all surprising. We've talked about this at length. The industry's gone from CBD to CBG to CBN to flower and now Delta 8. It's as if the hemp industry doesn't want to admit that what it is a multi-purpose commodity crop that's based in agriculture, that it wants to maintain this notion that you can produce high levels of these products and get rich quick, which is unfortunate. That said, there are strategies. But it's not advisable given all the political turmoil at this point in time. That's a mouthful, Eric.
That was a Hoban perspective right there. American ingenuity. This is the point that in the last couple of days, as articles have come out about this and people have shed their thoughts, this is what's stood out to me, is that we're sitting here 3 years, give or take, since the passage of the 18 Farm Bill that effectively legalized industrial hemp, legalized the production of this crop, gave farmers and rural communities a shining glimmer of hope for a future that didn't look particularly bright for the American farming and agricultural industry. And with the lack of guidance from the FDA, which is kind of being touted as the biggest obstacle to a wider adoption of CBD as an ingredient. What's left a lot of those 100%. That biomass out on those farms is a lack of regulatory action. Now, global pandemic aside, because that's obviously took a lot of people's attention, especially the FDA having to approve and move these vaccines through in the last year. Nevertheless, you still have these farmers out there who have this biomass, and this American ingenuity, this ability to not just take a loss like that is going to result in pushing people almost to the gray area. They didn't necessarily want to be in the gray area. They wanted to capitalize on this new crop, this new opportunity. And heck, a couple of years ago, Bob, as we talked about, people were making tens of thousands of dollars an acre growing for cannabinoid extraction with hemp. But they've been put into a little bit of a position here where they are moving a little bit into a gray market, and they're doing it because it was the only way to move that crop off of their field. It was the only market that was really emerging was a market for Delta 8, because the market for CBD had totally crashed. So you know, this is this complicated point here where, one, you know, when we get that FDA approval, what will it really mean for the market? You know, what will we really see? Will that really answer the question and the problem that these farmers are facing, that there's just a glut of material and not a stable price, all of that? But it also makes the point and kind of begs the point that maybe that's not the entire issue either. You know, maybe there were a lot of practices going on at that time with the growing of all of this, the crop, that would never have really made it that product's way into a big market mover like Coca-Cola or Dasani. When we had Asa Waldenstein in here a couple of weeks ago, you know, he made the point that a lot of the manufacturing practices, the good agricultural practices necessary to actually move material into those supply chains, they haven't been followed by American farmers. So, especially with hemp, just because there's been this lack of regulation and oversight and know-how. But that point about American ingenuity, I mean, I just think it's really something to hammer home. And it kind of brings us to another point, which is, when do we think the FDA will actually provide some guidance here? I want to come back to the other point that you made, though, too, about the marijuana industry having a vested interest to keep this on the sidelines, because that's something that I don't think is talked about enough, but it absolutely makes sense when you think about this compound as kind of a sneak around of the regulations for an intoxicating product.
Yeah, well, it's American ingenuity coupled with the fact that American businesses don't sit back and wait for government regulations. And by the way, this is a uniquely American thing based on my experience, and I'm sure there's exceptions to the rule. But let me put it this way. When legislation is enacted that legalizes a particular thing or makes a change, in every country I've worked in outside of the United States, the businesses steadfastly sit with their hands in their pockets and wait for the government to come out with regulations. Well, we can't do this until the regulations come out. No, oh, hell no, not in the United States. We're going to say it's legal. We're just going to go do this. It's up to you to quickly come up with the regulations. And that is, I think, a unique American perspective, because the government's there to not, well, in theory, it limits freedoms and rights through regulation. But unless that limit comes out, and unless there's a prohibition that's criminal, people are going to go out and do those things absent those regulations or until they come. Now, what happens when our regulations do come from the FDA? There's no way. Well, put it this way. When the FDA regulations come out, we're talking about large-scale businesses, Fortune 500 sorts, big time consumer packaged good manufacturers that are global in scope and national scope. They're going to play in this field. You're going to see CBD once again be reinvigorated as an additive or an ingredient in just about every single product you can find, from toothpaste to beverages to topicals to chapstick. And we see that in pockets now. Certainly we do, but not from Procter and Gamble's of the world. You're going to see that, mark my words. Now, here's the other side of that thing, though, is if that happens, do you think that, and I'm using Procter & Gamble, I don't know if Procter & Gamble is ever going to enter in this space, but I'm using that as an example. Is Procter & Gamble ever going to make an intoxicating product from hemp? Oh, hell no. No, they're not. They're not. It's just, it's not safe. It's very, very, very aggressive, absent regulations for that type of thing. So I think that you'll see this creativity die a little bit. But I also, unfortunately, think that a lot of the players in the existing cannabinoid extract game from the retail side, not necessarily the ingredient supply side, that unless they have a niche product, sports products, products that tailor to females in particular, niche markets, in other words, pet products, unique beverages, performance enhancement products, unless you have those niche categories for a brand, you're not going to be able to survive on the other side, because these companies have the production capability and the shelf space to dominate. So unfortunately, it will shrink the number of players in the market, but it'll elevate the products in terms of consistency, quality, and consumer protection overall. And you won't see these intoxicating products enter into the marketplace, because there's just no room for that in a FDA-regulated scenario. So that's what is very likely going to happen. It's literally making lemonade out of lemons, isn't it? It's, I've got this stuff. What am I going to do with it? Scientist X says, well, here's the thing that you can do with it. And there's, and the lawyer Y says, well, nothing prohibits this right now. So that is a natural thing. It's an American thing. And there's nothing wrong with it. But you also can't discount that sort of reflex position that goes, oh, wait a second, from law enforcement policymakers and otherwise, you got to slow down. You got to stop this. In fact, trade organizations came out. Don't you think, what was the U.S. Hemp Roundtable several weeks ago said, that they're not going to certify a product from a hemp derivative manufacturer that includes Delta 8 THC. My last thought on this, by the way, is, and I say this somewhat flippantly and maybe not 100% seriously, but why Delta 8? Why not just, why pussyfoot around? Delta 9 THC is not a controlled substance from industrial hemp. So if somebody really wanted to push the envelope and eliminate the synthesized synthetic issue, 0.3% THC is by dry weight. There are mechanisms to play with a non-controlled substance in a marketplace that's not yet fully regulated but is legal under the legislation. I don't know why we went straight to Delta 8 instead of going straight to Delta 9, but I can guess why.
Well, and now Delta 10 perhaps, but you know, Bob, you've been saying that for a while, and it comes down to that language that's in the farm bill that specifies the THC in the crop. If the crop is below, if the plant material tests below 0.3% THC, and you're able to extract Delta 9 THC out of it, it's not illegal. I want to come back to another point, which is in the absence of these FDA regulations or some kind of guidance, we've seen senators try to introduce legislation. It just happened again today with the same cast of characters, Rand Paul, Ron Wyden, introducing a bill to try to address this gray area for CBD and other hemp-derived cannabinoids. What's the advantage or disadvantage of trying to do something at the Senate level? I mean, are they just trying to push the FDA and say, guys, we really need you to do something here? We also saw Rand Paul a couple of months ago with the hemp bill that he put into play, I think, to raise the THC allowance to 1%. So what are these senators trying to accomplish? Is it just put pressure essentially on that regulatory agency to move a little quicker? Or if that bill did pass the Senate, what would that really mean?
Well, I'm going to take us back just a little bit. Senator Orrin Hatch, who's no longer in the U.S. Senate, he was a champion for the supplement industry, the natural products industry, nutraceuticals, if you will. Orrin Hatch had a direct dial to whoever was in leadership at the FDA. Orrin Hatch was in communication with the FDA on a regular basis. When the FDA did something badly or did not do something that it should have done, Orrin Hatch was the first person to pick up the phone and call the director or leadership at the FDA and say, what's going on, fellas? It was a perfect use of politics and political elected officials, not influencing, but interfacing with the agencies that they're set to proclaim policy for. It doesn't seem to be happening these days. Why isn't there a senator that's taken up the mantle? Senator Mike Lee, by the way, who was also a senator in the state of Utah, has expressed an interest in sort of taking on that perspective, but I haven't seen it happen. Why is there not a senator that has that relationship with the FDA? In the absence of that type of relationship, how do you create pressure, especially on an issue that you care about? And certainly you can't say that Rand Paul doesn't care about the industrial hemp industry. He definitely does, Kentucky-based and otherwise. So they're trying to put pressure on. But here's the reality of it. The reality of it is, if I'm mistaken here, correct me, but I believe it was September or October of 2020 when the FDA finally finalized and created its award for a third party private company to go out and procure and purchase 3,000 to 4,000 samples of CBD products in the marketplace to examine them, to dissect them, to test them, to figure out how they're being marketed. That is a year long plus or minus process. It hasn't even been 6 months since that occurred, or you know, certainly not 9 or 10 months since that's occurred. So the FDA is going through, I believe, a methodical process. Is it as fast as we would like? Oh no. Is it relying on the data that we already know exists? Of course it's not. But they're going about it their own way. Have things changed since Han was replaced by new appointee for the FDA under the Biden administration? I don't know the answer to that question, except to say that the FDA is on a process, bureaucratically and administratively, of gathering that information, and then it will make decisions based on that information. That's my understanding. So to make the FDA move more quickly than its determined and selected pathway process, I just think is not going to be fruitful. Unless you had a powerful senator who was interested in the topic and could drive the discussion, not improperly, not mixing the lines between the executive branch and the political, the elected officials branch of our government, Congress, but somebody that could sort of exert that influence in a way that was direct, not in a way that was, well, we're going to pass this legislation unless you move, because we've seen it before. And I think the FDA is going, yeah, you're, first of all, our process is our process. We don't care about your timeline. Go enact whatever legislation you want. We don't have a choice. We have to adapt to it, no matter what you do. So it's over our heads or out of our hands, perhaps. Secondly, the FDA, is legislation really going to pass that's going to require the expedited enactment and ultimate delegation of that authority to the FDA? So I think that people sitting around a table and having a discussion and advancing this topic is what needs to happen, not political saber rattling.
Well, science takes time, and you can't help but kind of sit here and feel, in lieu of this American ingenuity idea, that you can ban Delta 8, but then you're going to be banning something maybe a year from now. They're going to find something else to do with all of that material, because it's just like you said, this is this beautiful thing about America where we're not going to take that loss.
Nope.
If we don't have to. If there's something we can do with it, hey, we're going to figure out what it is. This kind of takes us, though, this conversation about the FDA to our last point, which is that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. One of the best things for mental health is just being back together with people. We experienced that today in a little lunch here at the Hoban Law Group, just being around people again, getting that human interaction. But, you know, another big step here for mental health and kind of medicine and treatments is the opening field of psychedelic medicines and psychedelic therapy. Now, if cannabis and CBD is not the Biden administration or the FDA's top priority, I can't imagine that psychedelics is a very high priority. However, it's impossible to ignore the tremendous strides that we have seen in that arena, even in recent history with this most recent election and Oregon coming out, legalizing psilocybin therapy, decriminalizing other substances. I believe Washington, D.C., decriminalized plant-based and fungi-based compounds and chemicals and psychedelics. So, you know, Bob, what can we look forward to? We had a great conversation with Saul Kaye kind of on this topic, but in the months to come, what do you think? Do you think that the mental health area and the FDA will be receptive to probably not the same path quite that cannabis has taken with this adult use model, but more in the field of clinical trials for developing medicines and therapies that could very well bear fruit for the future of that industry?
Yeah, I think it's a broader movement, Eric. I think it's a broader movement of making plant-based therapeutics, medicines available to people. Plant-based medicines from plants that have been ultimately restricted, criminalized, controlled for so long, and sort of opening that door based on a modern awareness, a more widespread modern awareness. There are certainly pockets of individuals that understood these plants provided these types of benefits for millennia, and certainly over the last 100 plus years. But I think that's the basis for this. That's why you see the cannabis legalization. That's why you see cannabinoids from the cannabis plant overall being utilized in a variety of different ways. And it's the same thing with psilocybin and other products that produce more of a psychedelic impact, but when taken in smaller quantities can provide relief from things like depression and anxiety and just your normal day-to-day issues in the world. And I think the future is not necessarily a marijuana dispensary-like system, although we've seen that in certain places outside of the United States for psychedelic mushroom psilocybin in particular. But it seems like there's a quicker pathway for trials and approval at the FDA for psychedelic-based medicines, particularly if it has to do with depression and chemical imbalances in the brain. That is something that we're seeing almost streamlined and made far more readily available than many of us would have thought. Far more readily available than using a Schedule I substance such as cannabis for therapeutics at the federal level in the United States, which is somewhat surprising. And one thing to note, though, is while the benefit for the masses would be tremendous if these psychedelic-based therapeutics were FDA approved and made available to the masses, presently, the market of users is far, far, far smaller than the users in cannabis. So it's not exactly apples to apples, not by a long shot. Marijuana is the most widely used, quote unquote, drug on the planet, whereas psilocybin is probably not even in the top 10, although I'd have no numbers to back that up. That's just what my gut tells me. So ultimately, there's a far easier pathway for clinical trials and for the use of these compounds in actual medicines than there are in distribution outlets that would allow the sale of mushrooms, for example, in the United States, even though we've seen decriminalization. And that's an interesting thing, because when you, it's sort of this topic we talked about earlier, Americans don't wait for regulations. Well, psilocybin's been decriminalized in many major cities across the United States. When marijuana began to be decriminalized or made legal, we started to see people start selling marijuana in, you know, cigarette stores and tobacco store, you know, head shops, convenience stores, and the like. Not regulated, but sold nonetheless, because in theory there weren't criminal repercussions. We're not seeing a whole lot of that with psychedelics, although we know it exists. And it also exists because there is not just psychedelics as it relates to fungi, mushrooms in particular, but mushrooms are being used in a variety of ways, not just psychoactive or psychedelic-based mushroom compounds. So you're seeing a lot of people grow mushrooms in settings where a variety of beneficial, nutritional, healthy mushrooms are being grown alongside of psilocybin mushrooms, and then sort of circumventing the law enforcement perspective. But that's American ingenuity at its finest, for better or for worse.
Just before we sign off, it's interesting because your comments around the plant-based model, that broader idea, reminds me a lot of when you got back from Davos, Switzerland, from the World Economic Forum, and you kind of expressed that really is the interest in the minds of a lot of these global leaders. You think about the movement for plant-based foods, this understanding that our dependence on meat is a huge emitter of carbon and greenhouse gases, and you're seeing that movement from a synthetic world almost to more of a plant-based world, which is funny because, yeah, like 100 years ago, everything was like plant-based, but...
Very well said. It was a notion from Davos that I came back with of plant-based economies. And, you know, in part because here's another notion, you know, world hunger, there should not be hungry people in the world. There is enough food and enough ability to create food, plants, to create food across this world to feed everybody 10 times over. So that's a basic notion. How do you instill that? Is, all right, well, let's localize that and create a plant-based economy around that to feed people. If people are fed and there's a plant-based economy, if those plants can do more than just feed people and provide nutritional benefit, then even better. And I think that's what we're starting to see. What's old is new again. What's ancient is new again.
You heard it here first on the Hoban Minute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.